This is Building Bridges with Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg. Prisons can't run without inmates. In more ways than one, prisoners, they wash floors and they work in the laundries and kitchens and provide a large amount of the labor that keeps their facilities running. In return, they earn pennies per hour or even no pay at all. That's sparking what may have been the largest prison strike yet as inmates across the country stopped working on September 9th.
The strikers are calling for an end to forced labor and what they call prison slavery. And it's no coincidence that they picked September 9th as the strike date. It was the 45th anniversary of the Attica Rebellion, when prisoners at the Attica Correctional Facility in New York demanded their rights in one of the most significant civil rights occurrences of the century.
Now we're joined by Cole Dorsey and Michael Forrest with the Incarcerated Workers Organization, and Michael is also with the Black Rose Anarchist Federation, and we've been joined unexpectedly but delightedly by Cindy, who's also working with the Incarcerated Workers Organizing Committee. And they're part of Industrial Workers of the World. And they're here to discuss the September 9th prison labor strike and some of the things that have been happening around so-called gang raids in New York. Now, Cole Dorsey, first of all, welcome. And I feel like we've got both coasts in the house, which is really a good thing. I recently reread a letter that said, and I quote, "I'm beginning to believe that the USA stands for the underprivileged slaves of America." That was written by a 20th century prisoner from Mississippi in a letter detailing the daily violence he witnessed behind prison walls. His statement resounds with a long tradition of prisoners, particularly African-American prisoners, who have used the language and narrative of slavery to describe the conditions of their imprisonment. And I wonder if you can talk to that and how that ties in with the September 9th strike. And again, welcome to WBAI.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity. Yeah, I think the important part is the real organizers of this call, Free Alabama Movement and other prison organizers, the important part that they like to distinguish is that the 13th Amendment did not outlaw slavery. To quote it, it says, "Abolish slavery, involuntary servitude, except as a punishment for crime." So I like to listen to a lot to what Melvin Ray and some of the other founders of FAM have to say on the subject. They wrote a good piece called "Let the Crops Rot in the Plantation Field." And one of the points they bring up is Angola, for example, how what was once a slave plantation never stopped production, the 13th Amendment. It just changed from private ownership into state ownership. So taking the profits from agriculture in the South, instead they made it prisoners as opposed to calling them slaves. A lot were caught by slave catchers or freed slaves, quote-unquote, were caught and put on trumped-up charges, put right back into the same institutions or same plantations that they had just thought that they had escaped. So it literally is. And then now we have, you know, there's like four states that don't pay at all, Texas, Colorado, a couple others that don't pay workers anything. And it's one thing, you know, as far as I'm concerned, you're doing work to keep something running, you should be compensated for it, just like anyone else on the outside. But the problem is that we don't only have prisoners running the facility. We have them now sewing for Victoria's Secret or packaging meat for McDonald's. So you have these major corporations not paying payroll taxes, not paying unemployment insurance, but getting that benefit of this 2.4 million labor force that is forced to languish in these prisons in the United States. So there really is a direct connection, and especially when we relate it to race and the fact of sentencing and how it more greatly affects people of color, poor people, poor working class people, people with mental illness, substance abuse issues. These are the people that are marginalized. These are the people that are cast out by society and considered expendable. So the state then, instead of deciding social welfare programs or trying to assist them or offering these types of jobs on the outside at prevailing or union wages, will incarcerate you at a mass level and force you to work or not get out. You know, a lot of parole is dependent on having a job. so what we see is that it's really become, the state has used it to their advantage with these private corporations and to perpetuate the same system of institutional racism and white supremacy that we had prior to the 13th Amendment.
And I don't know if our folks from up north want to address anything that their brother Cole Dorsey has said. Cindy,
I really appreciate what Cole laid out, and I would just add that in New York State specifically, a lot of people think that there is no private production in prisons, but there actually is. There is over a dozen facilities in New York that do what's called industry work, and the history of that is actually that a lot of that work is for state good, so like the trash cans in New York City are made in prison. The benches, actually, that you sit in court before you go to prison.
That's pretty ironic.
Yeah, are made by prisoners. It's really sick, actually. And the desks in a lot of schools are made by prisoners. There's a lot more commodities, too. And
so there are more desks made by prisoners than there are people who are incarcerated that actually get to sit in schools.
But definitely anyway. Assume that, yeah. And the really other kind of sick thing is that we've heard from people that we're connected to up inside that in New York, people want the industry jobs because the other jobs that Cole outlined, like, you know, maintaining the prison, people are making anywhere between 0 cents to 3 cents an hour. So there's a competition for these jobs where you're making $1.06 or 80 cents an hour. So it's really the prison system forces this to happen. And I think we'll talk about it a little bit later, but we're seeing now a lot of people that we know locally just up in the Bronx being also pushed into these conditions while their families kind of sit back and watch them be about to rot away upstate in these conditions.
Michael, how is the New York Committee supporting the prison labor strike?
So the New York chapter of the Incarcerated Workers Organizing Committee got started back in November last year by some of our comrades that helped set up a chapter in Rochester, New York City, and Providence. And we're fairly new, but since we started up, we've been in contact with previous IWOC members that were in contact with Incarcerated Workers Organizing Committee National. And we're also building new contacts with people inside prisons in New York State, specifically in the facilities that Cindy mentioned that produce industry products for the company Corecraft. So there's over a dozen companies in New York State that produce these products, and we've been sending cold letters into these prisons to try to talk with people about their conditions mm-hmm. there. And across the board, we found that conditions are horrible. People are not getting paid enough. They need more money and want to, you know, support their families but are unable to. So since we only started in November and more so in earnest only a few months ago talking to folks in New York State prisons, we're starting to develop contacts and put people in touch with each other. But we haven't been able to really see any solid actions happen with this short notice.
Well, Cole, I understand certainly. I think there were 24 to 26 states where there was organizing going on towards the initiation or the commencement of the strike on September 9th. I wonder if you can talk about the issue of how the organizing ensued, which is, you know, fascinating how people behind the walls can get out the word. It's not entirely clearly through supporters. So what was that like? What was the organizing process? And what are people actually organizing to? Is it forming a union? Is it being treated equivalently to civilian employees? What are the predominant issues?
There's different demands depending on whatever location they're at. So South Carolina prisoners have created a list of demands. In Alabama, they have a freedom bill that they're trying to push. Here in Merced, we have two county jails where there are five different blocks that are all on hunger strike. We also have the women's prison in Chowchilla that they're on lockdown because they have refused to work. So we have a number of what we consider it's, what happened was is because we've been preparing for it since like April or when the call came out around April, administration got wind of it. So rather than give the glory to the prisoners and let that potentially create a firestorm across the country, they preemptively put most of these institutions on lockdown where we have members or where we're corresponding regularly through letter writing and things like that. But now we also have a big part of IWALK as well is including family members. So, you know, we get information through family members, we get information through phone calls, we get information through letters. It's no secret that there's contraband cell phones within the prisons in this country, and that's why FAM has been so has been able to get the word out so well through their YouTube channel, through being able to have Skype interviews with KFPA and other other people like that. So we utilize that where we have it, and where we don't, we have to rely on snail mail. But we're getting a process better equipped to be able to respond. So in a lot of ways, you know, you send, like, for example, here in California, I'll send a couple newsletters to one cell block, and it'll be passed along, you know, if you've got 50 in a cell block or whatever it might be, you know, that information gets passed along relatively quickly. So one or two members that we might have in a cell block, and then we'll get a call, letters back saying, I want information. So we have over 200 members in California. Now, the other important part I wanted to bring up is that while there are demands, we see this connection between the school-to-prison pipeline, the fact that police are indiscriminately killing black people, mass incarceration, the war on drugs, this continuation of white supremacy and institutional racism. So these respective demands, obviously, we fight for and we're pushing for, but at the end of the day, we see it as one system, and we want to end that system in and of itself. So a good quote that I always like to use from the initial call for all prisoners to go out was to cease reproducing institutions of your confinement. So basically, to quote from Melvin Ray, if we take the incentive away from the state and these corporations to use prison labor, then they'll be forced to pay either other workers or have to figure something else out. They'll have to deal. They'll have to negotiate. So, yeah, we do. As George Jackson claimed before he was executed in San Quentin, he said all prisoners should be unionized in one union and be able to collectively bargain. In 1977, the Supreme Court said they couldn't. That doesn't mean that, especially in the IWW, we really don't care what the government says, because we know that solidarity and sticking together means more than any law they can make.
Well, we all hear that, and we're all smiling, actually. I just want to, about your personal interest as we continue this, we have certainly in studio two young people, and I'm interested in why they care about these issues, and I'm interested in your particular interest, and also, Cole, what you know of other punitive action that has been taken against people who were participants or efforts to participate in this strike.
Sure. Yeah, my personal connection is I was incarcerated in Michigan for 3 years for delivery of narcotics, and it was while I was incarcerated that I kind of got reacquainted. Prior to going to prison, I was politically active young person, and then got involved with drugs, like a lot of people my age did around me at that time. I did my 3 years, but during that time, it was a young member of the Nation of Islam, and it was through our discussions that it kind of got repoliticized. We had a lot of discussions on race and class, and the distinction, you know, of course, that I always pointed out right away was the clarity on a clarification on the white man as the pig. And as we walked the yard, I remember Isaiah X, he would tell me, he said, Cole, you don't have any power over me any more than anybody else on this yard does. To me, or at least his understanding, as he explained it to me, was that they saw the white man as the power structure, or those judges, landlords, police officers that had now for centuries been the ones oppressing them. So through that, we started using a portion of his Nation of Islam time in what we called community development program. And initially, we just talked about how we all got there. and then talked about the system, read about the system a bit. But I was always real open and honest about my experience being a white man and through the system, being in the same room. At one point, there was 12 of us, and I was the only white person at the beginning. And, you know, I was always very honest about the fact that I got three. I mean, all the money I made selling drugs, I had to give to a lawyer, number one. So I did get a good lawyer, but despite that, the fact that I got 3 years for the charges that I had when I was sitting in a room with black men who got three times as much time for a similar type charge. So the fact that we were able to discuss those things, and then we developed and branched out because the state didn't offer any resources. They gave you a bus ticket and say, here you go, go back home, get a job, be a productive member of society. Well, what we did as a group amongst ourselves, self-organized, was if we knew a member of our little group was getting out anytime soon, we tried to collect resources for education, if they needed their GED, housing, if they needed it, shelters or any other type of housing, and any potential work, you know, like temporary work or anything else that we could direct them towards before they got out to try to assist them. So in a way, it was trying to take the power and try to empower ourselves through that way. So a month after I got out in 2004, I joined the Industrial Workers of the World, and I've been organizing ever since with the IWW, kept at my dues ever since. So it was a couple of years ago when IWOC formed. I moved out here to California, and I was asked by some other members of the IWW, because of my experience being incarcerated, if I'd be willing to start corresponding with inmates here in California. So I was kind of recruited to IWOC, but I'm glad I was, because I remember what it meant to me to receive support and to know that people didn't forget about me on the outside. So I'm glad to be able to do that for others now.
And we're glad as well.
And Michael, prisoners are really paid nothing, or they're paid like 23 cents an hour or something like that. And there are over 900,000 prisoners who are working in the institutions, and most of these institutions depend heavily on the prison labor to function. If wages were raised to an even minimum wage, would that have an impact on the system of mass incarceration?
Yeah, I think the question of raising income to minimum wage is actually like antithetical to the system of prison that we have, because prison itself is created to take away black men out of their homes and keep them economically, financially, you know, oppressed. And the prison uses black men as slave labor. So, and this is taking resources out of black and brown communities. So the idea of paying them minimum wage, of course, it goes against the nature of the prison system. Certainly folks that are locked up would like to be able to work for their families and provide for their families while they're locked up, and not be a financial liability for their families. So it would definitely help a lot, and I think it's you know, the minimum that people need in prisons to get paid for their labor and not remain slaves.
Now, I just want to switch gears a little bit. This is an ongoing topic for us, so we welcome all of you back, and we'll continue to pursue it. And this is all part of a series we're doing, Shut 'em Down, because, frankly, the issue is ultimately prison abolition. But I want to ask both Cindy and Michael a little bit. We have very limited time, but a little bit about some of these arbitrary raids in our communities, in public housing projects in particular, where they pick up people en masse. Why don't you talk about some of those so-called gang raids and what you also, as activists, have been doing in relationship to that?
So real quick, what a lot of people are talking about and recognizing is that just at the moment where Stop and Frisk was challenged, in New York City, we've seen a shift immediately to so-called gang raids, where police are no longer picking up, to the same extent, black and brown men off the streets, but going into their homes and communities to take them out of their beds at night. So this started happening last year with a very large raid on the Grant houses in Harlem, where over 100 young men were taken in. And just recently on April 27th in Eastchester, Bronx, 120 young men were taken in the middle of the night and caught up on RICO charges, and now they're sitting in prison in MDC and MCC in Brooklyn
and Manhattan.
They're
in federal prison, actually, right?
Yep. The raids were conducted by federal government, including ICE, the feds, and many other agencies.
Homeland Security was involved, I believe.
Seven agencies. Over 700 officers, 120 people.
So what we're seeing is, you know, this process where men are taken out of their communities, and some of these men eventually be sent upstate and be some of the people that, you know, are working for very low wages and things like this. So as members of IWOC, we're not just trying to fight and organize with people already in prisons, but we want to get at the issue where it starts, which is police in the community.
Well, lastly, but I want to know how people can get in touch with, get involved in the Black Rose Anarchist Federation, get involved in the IWOC committee, the Incarcerated Workers Organizing Committee, and also how people can find out more about the strike. So let's start with Cole Dorsey. How can people find out more about the strike? This is just the first salvo. It's an ongoing effort until we build that wall-to-wall union of prison labor, workers of the world, because indeed we have nothing to lose, literally and figuratively, but our chains. How do people find out more about it, Cole?
Yeah, absolutely. It's iwalk.noblogs.org, and we'd also encourage you to go support prisonerresistance.net and, of course, the freealabamamovement.com.
Well, listen, thank you very much for being with us and for all the organizing that you do and for the information you're imparting to us. And we're there to support our sisters and brothers inside. And next time we also have to find out a little bit more about the sisters who are organizing, which sometimes we have a tendency to forget are part of the process. So thanks for the good work. And Michael, Cindy, how do people get in touch with you folks up here to support the parents and families of those young people who are picked up in these outrageous, arbitrary, conspiratorial raids, and there's not a smoking gun there amongst any of the people who have been held, and we should say they've been held mostly in federal prison. They've had no right to see a judge. The charges are, as most conspiracy charges, about indicting a ham sandwich. So how do people get in touch?
So the first thing that people can do is visit www.bronx120.org, and there you can donate, and you can also read a public letter from one of the mothers about the situation with her son and find out about information coming up. Real quick, there's two things coming up Wednesday at the base, which is located in Bushwick. There will be a call-in to support prisoners all over the country, and also we've heard that there's been retaliation and repression of the youth inside MDC and MCC because of their family members speaking out, particularly at our demonstration on September 9th. And you can get in touch with IWOC at iwoc.nyc@riseup.net.
Do that one more time.
So Bronx 120, BRONX120.org, and if you want to get in touch with IWOC, iwoc.nyc@riseup.net.
Well, we insist on you coming back. Let's get some of the parents here, and let's really explore this issue and build the kind of support movement that we should. So we want to thank Cole Dorsey and Michael Forrest with the Incarcerated Workers Organizing Committee, Industrial Workers of the World, and Cindy with IWOC, and, of course, Michael also is with the Black Rose Anarchist Federation. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks, Cole. Thank you, guys.
Yeah. Inmates in as many as 40 prisons in 24 states across the U.S. are on strike, refusing to work in protest to what they call modern-day slavery.
The 13th Amendment of the Constitution of the United States assures that slavery will be abolished except for those incarcerated, which means if you have been convicted of a crime and you are serving jail time in a prison, post-trial, post-conviction, it is perfectly legal for the government to enslave you and to conscript you into labor that you don't necessarily want to perform for a pittance of a salary.
But in places like Texas, Arkansas, and Georgia, inmates are not paid at all. At times, work is performed for private, for-profit companies like Walmart, Victoria's Secret, and IBM. It's not just fair wages that they're calling for, but rather wide-scale reforms within the prison system.
From prison rape elimination, to access to medical care, to oversight that includes due process methodologies installed to protect these vulnerable populations are all part of this suite of demands that prisoners, inmates, and the incarcerated population across America is calling for.
The protests have been organized by the inmate-led Free Alabama Movement and coordinated by the Incarcerated Workers Organizing Committee, along with the support of other groups. The exact number of prisoners participating in the strike is unclear because authorities at correctional facilities have not made the numbers public. However, organizers say they're able to receive periodic updates and the strike is indeed ongoing. The strike comes on the 45th anniversary of the Attica prison uprising, when inmates in the notorious New York correctional facility revolted and demanded better living conditions. However, it's clear many of the reforms demanded over four decades ago have yet to be addressed. Susan Madaris, Press TV, New York.
This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.